Great to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk. I think it's your weekly resource for all things gardening. Larry Mueller here. And Bruce Spangenberg is back with us. He's the statewide horticulture outreach specialist in the Hort program at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. He also writes the weekly gardening column. It's titled Wisconsin Yard and Garden, and you should take a look at it. It's every week, some great information from Bruce. We'll talk to him about the plants that are great pollinators at this time of the year. We've got some fall flowering plants that really work well. And of course, we'll take your other gardening questions as well as we move along. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Bruce Spangenberg, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be back.
Lots of insects and butterflies and moths out and about right now, and kind of important to provide food for them right now.
Yeah, I think it's kind of overlooked, and that's why I did that column recently. We've had a lot of nice weather the last couple of weeks, unusually warm, dry weather, a lot of, breezy days, and a lot of things are flying around, including monarch butterflies and other things. So one of the things, people look at pollinator gardens or specifically trying to help monarch butterflies. A lot of times they focus on the larva, planting milkweed and similar plants for the larva to feed on. But the adults have to migrate all the way down to Mexico. So they got a long flight. They need energy. So one of the things you can do to help is to plant plants that bloom here in the fall, starting in late August into September, even into early October, so they can kind of fuel up on their way by providing that pollen and nectar.
Yeah. And we need to place them, for the most part, I think, in sunny locations, right?
Yeah, that's one of the limiting things. Most of the plants that are preferred are going to be full sun. By that we mean usually a minimum of 6 hours of sunlight a day rather than in the shade. But yeah, out in the sun, and especially in the cooler mornings, the insects prefer the sun too. They warm up faster during the fall.
Yeah, well, let's take a look at some of the more popular fall flowering plants. I'm seeing, in my neighborhood, I'm seeing a lot of asters. Right now. And maybe you could talk a little about asters.
Yeah, I think that, the typical one that's on the list for the fall, it's a native, is New England aster. Do you also have the coneflowers? A lot of things, they don't have to be native. That's usually the preference. But, typically, in landscapes, you can have a combination. There's no rule that says you have to have all native plants, but certainly natives are at the top of the list. The asters, coneflower, even some of the annuals, verbena, zinnias, things like that. If you still have them blooming, you'll see that, they do attract a lot of pollinators here this time of year.
A few of my neighbors have sunflowers, and they, I think, are a type of aster.
I believe so. Yeah, it's a big family of closely related plants there, and you're right. There are a number of the sunflowers, traditional garden sunflowers, and some of those are still blooming. Of course, some are producing seed, and that of course attracts the birds to eat the seeds as well. So you get the double impact there on the pollinators, and then on the birds later for the seed.
Yeah, just thinking in general about asters. Is it let's talk soil first.
Yeah, usually you want to have well-drained soil. They're not real finicky, but, decent drainage. Usually the limiting factor is if you got, a lot of clay and you got a soil that stays wet too long. Now, having said that, you can go on our website. We have a list of pollinator plants and native plants. And if you do happen to have an area that is wet, stays wet most of the time, you can adjust that and plant some plants that are better suited to wet soil. But typically the biggest stumbling blocks are going to be too much shade or a soil that's just, really heavy clay, compacted, or maybe it's all gravel, it's in fill, that kind of thing. So you might have to do a little modification with the soil, add some organic matter, that kind of thing that we always talk about. But overall, they're not plants that are real high maintenance plants. The main requirement is good drainage and full sun, or near full sun, so that they have the opportunity to grow.
Are we getting a little late if you consider planting them now? Is that a bit late?
Yeah, I mean, usually, whether it depends if you're going to seed or plant transplants, but typically you're looking at the spring. So that's, you know, one of the things that I mentioned in an article was not necessarily to rush out and try to add something here in the next week or so, but looking ahead to next year, because then you can kind of look at your whole landscape plan. Maybe you got spring flowers, you know, bulbs and other early bloomers. Maybe you got the traditional summer perennials, but now you could add some things in the fall that give you not only the benefit to the pollinators, but also add some extended color to your palette in your landscape, you know, and try to get as much, as long as possible, have some color out there to look at.
Yeah. And they're pretty much, I'm thinking about availability in spring. They're pretty available, are they not?
Absolutely. Yeah. Garden centers, nurseries, whether it be local, whether it be mail order. Yeah, they are. There's a lot of, you know, opportunities, and, you know, we're seeing more and more awareness, more and more people, you know, looking at ways they can help pollinators. So it just helps the nursery industry make these plants available, knowing that they have a market for them. So, yeah, they should be available, but typically looking at spring. So now you're kind of looking over the winter months, planning, which is always the key to a good landscape, and then make those purchases in the spring.
Mark in Arlington has something that relates to this, I believe. Mark, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're loud and clear.
Okay, up at Goose Pond, now called Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, is the owner in the state of Madison Audubon. We've been tagging monarchs for many years, and what we did is when we caught a monarch on a nectarine plant, we recorded it. We recorded over 5,700 monarchs tagged on nectarine plants in the fall, of course, this time in the middle of September and September. 50% of the monarchs in fall, we've got all the prairie plants out there, 50% of them are nectarine on showy goldenrod. That's the key plant for them. It attracts them better than any of the goldenrods or asters. It's still flowering, but when that's done, then they're going to go on New England asters. But their preferred one is showy goldenrod. And those are two that come to mind real easily. Some of these are pretty aggressive, like sawtooth sunflowers or nectarine, but I would concentrate on the showy goldenrod. And if you were in your yard early in the migration and that, if people would be planting metal blazing star, like Atrus Ligustylus, and some of our friends have planted that, and the most anybody I've heard of in the fall migration has seen 17 monarchs on one plant. So that's one that you should check out with the garden centers and the prairie nurseries.
Yeah, good tips sure. There, Mark. Thank you for calling. Bruce, you're nodding in agreement with what Mark had to say.
Yeah, yeah, and actually all three of those I did mention in that column. But yeah, in goldenrod, sometimes, you know, it still gets a bad rap because people still have that association with hay fever and allergies, which there is no connection. Goldenrod has one of the heavier pollens. It's not windborne. But, yeah, absolutely. It's another plant that very easy to grow, and it attracts a lot of pollinators, no question about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it, and appreciate the research you're doing out there as well. Appreciate that very much. Nick in Fort Atkinson, your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hi, I just wanted to point out, I can't remember the scientific name for it. It starts with a T, but common name is nuts and sunflower. And I've been growing these the last couple of years, but last year my neighbor boy, he's become my little junior botanist buddy, and coming over and checking out the plants and the pollinators through the last couple of years. We were really sad. We only saw a couple of monarchs the whole year last year. So I went crazy this year and planted like 20 of these nuts and sunflowers, watered them, fertilized them really well. I've got like 10, 12-foot plants all over my yard, and we're finding dozens of monarchs on them at a time, not to mention the bumblebees are falling asleep on them every night. It's been almost just magical to see how many monarchs have been attracted to that plant. So I just wanted to bring that up to people. It's a fairly hardy plant, pretty easy to grow. You don't have to even go as crazy with it like I did. I guarantee water it when it gets wilty. So I think it's a pretty good, like, beginner plant to get people you know, to attract some monarchs to the yard and other pollinators as well. Just wanted to bring that one up and say.
Nick, thanks a lot, Bruce.
Yeah, that's another one in the aster family. Yeah, absolutely.
So another good, the Mexican sunflower, another good suggestion.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Susan in Oregon, we'll go to you. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'm calling about these big areas that people have this pampas grass. Usually it's kind of by the end of their driveway, and I'm seeing it all over the place. And I had something like that in my yard at one time in a defined area, but I started noticing it was invading my native areas, so I got rid of it. And I don't know if I should be bothered when I see this, but I'm seeing it all over the place. People have these big areas right outside their driveway of all this, what I'm calling pampas grass. I'm sure it's not native. And what is your thought about it?
Yeah, excellent question, because that also brings up the whole issue of nomenclature and naming plants. I mean, pampas grass is a common name, and there's probably three or four different species that go by that common name, or sometimes are called that common name. The true pampas grass is actually not hardy here. It's in the south. It has a real white seed head on it. But I know the one you're talking about, there is some invasive. Miscanthus is a genus. Now, Miscanthus sinensis is the one that we do. It is recommended for landscapes. It's not native, but it's also not invasive. But there's also an invasive Miscanthus that's very well suited to low areas. And you'll see it, like you say, along driveways or people planted in a swale or a ditch in front of their property. And then it does spread and it chokes out everything. And it really has no value as far as wildlife and landscape or wildlife and pollinators and that type of thing. It just takes out a lot of the native plants. And that is unfortunate. So it is an education kind of thing. You know, and again, it goes back to knowing what plant you got. Start with by the proper Latin name or scientific name, botanical name, whatever you want to call it, and then go from there. But know what you're planting before you plant it. And unfortunately, sometimes people have planted that because it is easy to grow and it spreads, so it does help control erosion maybe and that kind of things. But the downside is it is invasive and it causes some serious problems. The DNR, if you Google DNR, and also it's connected to our website, you can see the list of plants that are invasive, and it does change. You know, if you go back 20 years ago, there's plants that were recommended that now are considered invasive and are no longer legal to sell. So it is an ever-changing kind of thing. But unfortunately, we do get the invasives. And as you say, most of those are not native. They come from other parts of the world, and they just have no predators, so to speak. There's nothing really that eats them. They don't get diseases, so they readily spread and unfortunately become serious headaches mm-hmm. in the landscape.
Yeah, indeed. Susan, thank you so much. Bruce Spangenberg, our guest today, statewide horticulture outreach specialist with UW-Madison's Division of Extension. He resides in the horticultural program, of course. You can join in with your questions. We've talked about, or we're talking about, pollinators, pollinator plants for fall, but we're obviously taking all kinds of other questions, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Coming up in the second hour of the show, Dr. Death Brian Huddleston is back to talk about the most common plant diseases he's seen this year, and we'll be talking with him about that topic. Right now, Bruce Spangenberg, happy to be with us, I think. No, he always has a smile on his face for Garden Talk. We're dealing with fall flowers for monarchs. We'll talk about some of the other plant diseases that relate to them. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. I lost a big section of my front prairie flower display because of some road construction, and there were a lot of purple coneflowers. I think there's about 2 feet left. But those the coneflowers are another plant, and black-eyed Susans, I think, mm-hmm. as well, that are good fall bloomers.
Absolutely, yeah. Dependable. Absolutely.
Yeah. the black eyes, they a little susceptible to septoria, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, we're fortunate Brian's coming on in the second hour, so
yeah,
he can deal with the disease. But yeah, I think one of the problems you run into when you get stands that are a little bit too thick and they stay wet, you know, a little bit longer, and you do get some of the, you know, septoria, some of the leaf spot diseases that I'm sure Brian will be talking about. You know, obviously, that's been a big disease the last couple of years, especially on lilac. But yeah, sometimes you get into some problems. It might just be a stretch of weather we get. You know, we get a stretch of cloudy, warm weather with some moisture, and some of those diseases have the opportunity. But normally those plants will bounce back. You know, it's just kind of you might get a bad year, a bad stretch of weather, but then the weather reverses itself and things take care, you know, get better. But it goes back to, you know, full sun, like we talked about, matching the site conditions to what the plant requires. Full sun, good drainage are usually the two biggest things we look at to help alleviate or prevent a lot of those problems from occurring in the first place.
Yeah. Deborah and Nina, we'll go to you next. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, thank you. We have a lot of showy goldenrod in our front yard, and we're members of Wild Ones, and we purchased them at our local plant sale in the chapter of Fox Valley. And one of the things that we as an organization are worried about is neonicotinoids. So we've got all these wonderful plants that are attracting lots of bees. Like every bunch of flowers has about a dozen or more bees on them. But now what's happening, you know, with the neonicotinoids in our neighborhood? And I understand that they're even put in seeds from some of the places that you might purchase even native plants.
Yeah. Bruce, comment?
Yeah, again, you know, that came up last time I was on the show also. You know, it's a relatively newer group of insecticides. And, you know, initially they came, as they came about, you know, the pluses were, you know, they were easy to use and they didn't have a lot of drawbacks. But obviously that's changed now because they are, a lot of them are systemic. They get into the plant, they stay there, and they could have an impact on pollinators. So the best advice there is, you know, it goes back to when we talk about managing pest problems. Resist the temptation to just spray without knowing what you've got. You know, try to figure out what the problem is. Look at all the possible ways to manage it, whether we're talking about insects. You know, Brian will be talking about diseases in the second hour today. You know, look at the cultural things, you know, like we just talked about, you know, having the right site conditions, good soil, looking at alternative plants, resistant plants, that kind of thing, to minimize the use of insecticides to begin with. And then if you do need an insecticide, be aware of the different groups, try to use the least toxic, you know, a lot of the things that are more favorable, some of the microbials, like, you know, the Bacillus thuringiensis products that are actually a bacteria. Insecticidal soaps, another one that's very environmentally friendly. It fits into a lot of organic programs. You know, look at all the possibilities. And in some cases, look at just tolerating a little bit of insect damage. You know, sometimes it's not, you know, you look at a plant that's got an insect on it, doesn't mean you have to control it. Yes, it might feed on a little bit of foliage, but knowing what the pest is, knowing what its potential is, it, you know, just live with it if it's just going to do minor damage. Now, the flip side is you have some insects that might spread virus diseases that Brian might be talking about. There's a different case. Or if you're growing a crop and you have a potential insect that can cause economic loss, then you have to take a different approach. But even then, look at your other alternatives as far as insecticide use and avoid that group altogether.
Yeah. How do you pick out, or how do you know when you go to the garden center if a plant might be a neonic plant?
As far as the insecticide, you have to look. The best thing to do would be, and I don't have the whole group memorized of all the insecticides that fall in that group, but the best thing to be would be to look, do some research, find out what insecticides fall in that group. And then if you do encounter an insect problem in your landscape or in your garden and you do need to use an insecticide, look at what insecticides will manage that insect. And if any of them are in that neonicotide group, then make the decision, I'm not going to use those, I'm going to use something else altogether. And I think you're seeing more and more of that when you look into control recommendations, where typically as much as possible, insecticide recommendations are focusing on the least toxic, the least environmental concern, you know, insecticidal soaps, the microbials, that kind of thing, rather than, you know, most of the old broad spectrum insecticides are gone. You know, years ago, you had things like Dursman, you had Diazinon, those kind of things, which have all disappeared. And this next group will probably, the next one to go will probably be the neonics as much as possible.
Deborah, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Tyler in Madison will go to you now. Hi, Tyler.
Hi. I was just wondering if all milkweed is, you know, kind of the same as, you know, for monarchs. We have two really big rose milkweeds that we planted, and I was just wondering if, you know, we should add some other kinds or if rose is good enough.
Yeah, there are several types. That is a good one. You know, the butterfly weed is also a plant that people, you know, monarchs will go to, and other butterflies and other pollinators will go to as well. I don't, you know, you can, again, there's a lot of good resources out there, but what you, again, when you get into the different types of milkweeds, you start getting into that nomenclature that I mentioned where you got the botanical name and the Latin name, and you have to pay very close attention because sometimes the common names will overlap. So if someone just says milkweed, that could actually entail several different species. So that's why we have plant lists like on our website and other places where you can get the actual names, the botanical names, and then when you go to purchase them, whether it be mail order, whether it be a local nursery or garden center, you want to see the actual botanical name of that plant that you're getting so you have the match that you're looking for. But yeah, the rose milkweed is fine. There's other ones as well.
Yeah. All right. Tyler, there you go. Thank you for calling. Susan wonders about garden mums, like the ones we see this time of year in stores. Are they good for pollinators?
They're not high on the list. And again, there's different reasons for that. But one of the things you run into, and this is sometimes we get into debates when we talk about native plants and we talk about cultivated plants and what's happened with a number of the natives, and this includes native grasses as well, over the years, because of popularity, we now have cultivars of the native plants. You know, for example, big blue stem, little blue stem, switchgrass, some of the native prairie grasses, we have different cultivars available. So what happens sometimes when we, when a cultivar, which is a man-made essentially variation of a species, you're trying to look at, you know, through plant breeding, you're picking out one characteristic. Now with mums, typically it's going to be obviously how showy they are, how many flowers they have, the size of the flower, the color of the flower. So it may be features that are going to be at the expense of something like the quality of the pollen. And I know there's been different articles written. There's been research trials done looking at pollen sources, native versus cultivated plants. And you'll see the native plants, like the one caller mentioned with the Leatris and some of the other ones, where you see much higher populations of the insects going to them because it's the plant has not been altered through crop breeding. So that's always a knock on cultivars is, you know, we've altered them in some way. Typically it's going to be visual or, you know, growth habit, color, whatever it's going to be, which might be at the expense of the pollen itself. So, so to answer your question, that's kind of a long answer, but basically they don't have a lot of value. I mean, you'll see insects on them. You know, I've got some mums on our porch and I've seen some bees and things going there, but it's not their first choice. But they, you know, it's a showy flower. They may come to it, but the quality of the pollen and the nectar is not there.
Yeah. The, I think Leatris came up in a conversation during the show, and that's a good native for fall planting and for attracting insects.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's actually one of my favorites. I've got some in my yard. Deer tend to leave them, and that's always the other issue, what do deer eat? Deer tend to leave them alone, but I've had them in one spot for 3 years unaltered and are unaffected by deer, and then one morning I went out there and half of them were gone because the deer showed up and decided to eat them. So just be, you know, we say deer resistant does not mean deer immune. And the other thing is you'll find that rabbits love them, because I, for some reason, have a high population of rabbits where I'm at right now, which I didn't have previously. So now I'm finding the rabbits are eating things that the deer ignore. But Liatris is a great plant because, you know, it does bloom late in the summer. It's got a pretty good extended bloom, very showy plant, you know, very nice, you know, that light purple color, or some different variations available. And it does attract a lot of insects, you know, monarchs, but also a lot of pollinators, you know, butterflies, bees, other things are readily attracted to them.
And another one I was thinking of that I really like is really beautiful, and I can't grow it because it needs a kind of a wet soil, is the cardinal plant.
Yeah, cardinal flower, which is a lobelia. I actually added some this year. I do give them a little extra water. And knock on wood, so far the rabbits and the deer have totally ignored it. So yeah, it's another good one.
and they will get along in partial shade. I mean, they full.
Mm-hmm. But and they do, yeah, they'll tolerate some shade. Not deep shade, but, you know, sun, a little bit of shade, yes. But they do like it a little bit more on the moist side. Very showy, and they do attract pollinators, including hummingbirds.
Yeah, and they're a hummingbird magnet. Mm-hmm. they love them. Dave in Appleton, we'll go to you now. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Judy has planted hundreds of zinnias, many varieties. First year she did that, and they are just a magnet for every kind of a tiny little bee pollinator to a tiny butterfly to monarchs, just everything. So how are they generally, first year doing this, as pollinators? And what about other annual plants for pollinators?
Yeah, as you mentioned, zinnia is right at the top of the list as far as a good annual flower that does attract pollinators. Verbena attract pollinators as well. A lot of butterflies I've seen, especially tiger swallowtails on them. Those are probably two at the top of the list. I mean, the thing, again, some of these, and petunias are a good example. There's all different kinds of petunias. They're well-suited for hanging baskets. But again, I think through some of the breeding, you get the visual quality, but you don't have the attractiveness to pollinators. So you'll get some in there, but not as many. You'll get bees in there sometimes, depending on the variety. But most, again, going back to what we mentioned at the very beginning, full sun annuals or annuals that like full sun are more likely to attract insects. And the other basic biology, as far as we go back to a lot of the native plants, yellows and purples, as far as flower color, tend to attract more insects. Those are two colors that insects are readily drawn to. So that's another thing you can look at. But yeah, I would look at zinnias. I would look at verbena. Annuals.
Mexican sunflower is an annual,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Right, it is. Yeah, we mentioned that before. Yes, that's another annual. Cosmos, you might get some insects in there as well. Butterflies in particular.
Yeah. Dave, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, with your plant question. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And we'll be taking up plant diseases in the second hour of the show. We'll zero in on that for the second hour. But any other plant questions, I hope you'll join in. Evergreen trees are called evergreens because they're always green, except a couple of exceptions, I guess. So should we worry when we get needles dropping for changing color?
It all depends. But the reason I just did that column, because right now we do get what we call seasonal needle drop. You know, I'm up here in the northern part of the state where we have a lot of white pine. We also have a lot of red pine. And white pine in particular, you can go from a tree that's perfectly green, and then like the next day you look at it and suddenly it's got all these yellow needles on it, and you're concerned, thinking, you know, it's got an insect or disease problem. But it is what we call seasonal needle drop, and the best thing, or the best way to diagnose it, look at where the yellow, and they may turn brown, or in the case of red pine, they typically just turn brown. Austrian needles just turn brown, but it should be the inner or the older needles. So if you look at the branch, you'll see, like on the white pines, yellow in the interior, and all of a sudden it stops and you got green as you work your way out on the branch. They do shed their older needles, especially in the fall. White pines are heavy shedders. And in fact, up here now, most of those already have fallen with some of the wind. But red pine, the hang on Austrian, you can see it on Scots pine. You can also see it on arborvitae. But just pay attention to where you're seeing it. You know, if it's just the old needles toward the center and there's a real abrupt change from yellow or brown to green, as I mentioned in that column, it's good news because that is seasonal needle drop. It's perfectly normal, nothing to do. But if the whole branch is dead, or if you're just seeing new growth dying, then that's a Brian Huddleston question for later. But now you're dealing with probably an insect or a disease problem. It could be a needle blight, needle cast. It could be a canker problem. It could be an insect problem. Now you don't have that distinction where you had the old needles suddenly change to the green new needles and you were fine. Now you got something else going on that you probably have to investigate.
Email, going back to liatris and cardinal flowers, do you recommend using seed for those? And if so, when should they go in?
I prefer to start out as transplants just because, you know, when you direct seed in the garden, things get lost sometimes. But some of these do self-seed. Cardinal flower, I believe, will self-seed. I know butterfly weed seed, you know, if you got those pods on them now, they're going to break open and they're going to self-seed. So I would prefer, generally, I prefer personally to start as transplants. And I usually recommend that to somebody just starting out because that way you see the plant, it's bigger. The problem sometimes when you direct seed, things come up, but you also got weeds coming up at the same time. And the seedlings are really hard to tell apart. So you may end up either leaving everything and find out you got too many weeds there, or you're pulling out the stuff you seeded because you thought it was a weed. You know, that's part of the struggle. But once you gain some experience and know what the seedlings look like, then, you know, then you could, obviously it's more economical to seed, in particular, if you're dealing with a large area, you know, if you're trying to restore, you know, a quarter acre or more, definitely then you're looking at seeds as much more economical rather than trying to put in a bunch of transplants, which gets pretty costly.
Yeah. Patricia in Antigo emailed to report that the bees seem to like turtle head. They crawl into the flowers and it's still blooming. Earlier, they were all over the hollyhocks and, of course, Joe Pieweed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another one, Joe Pieweed, that's popular.
But turtle heads, they...
Yeah, I'm not real familiar with those.
I'd
have to do a little background on that.
Yeah, I'm not real familiar with them either, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, and that's another reason, and I know Latin names get difficult sometimes to pronounce and spell, but that's also helps avoid confusion because sometimes you get regional common names that are a little confusing or don't ring a bell, but the Latin name would. And another thing, like, you know, mention, you know, butterfly weed, sneeze weed, Joe Pye weed. Don't be discouraged by the term weed in there because, again, that's a common name. A weed is simply a plant out of place, and those plants are not weeds. They're desirable native plants. But, again, that's, you know, common names are a lot easier to say, a lot easier to spell in regular conversation, and that's why we do it. But they all have Latin names, which are a little more challenging to say and to spell.
All right. Well, I know you've got a column coming up on lawn care. We should probably just mention that. What's coming up with that?
Yeah, I just sent my column. I send out at the end of the week, so it gets published on our website on Monday, and it gets in a number of papers throughout the state. Yeah, I just did a column because, you know, obviously we've had the extended warm weather. We always say fall is an excellent time for lawn care, and I know you had Doug on a few weeks ago. Yeah. And it did his annual fall show. But we do reach that cutoff point, and we're at that point right now, I should say, in particular with seeding. Now, people say, well, we're talking about record high temperature today. Why can't I go out and seed my lawn? Certainly you can, but my point is, as you get further and further along into fall, it gets riskier and riskier because we don't know what's going to happen. You need a nice 4 to 6 week time frame there from seeding to get the seedlings up, allow them to establish themselves and then harden off before winter sets in. So normally that cutoff is about September 15th. Now, as soon as I say that, people say, well, I seeded on October 5th last year and it worked. There's always the exception, but playing the percentages, you know, we're already at, what is today, the 3rd of October. So you know, even if you seed this weekend and it's in the 80s, that grass seed is probably going to germinate really fast. But, you know, 2 weeks from now, it could be 18 degrees. Now, hopefully it's not. But so you do run that risk. So I would be really cautious about seeding, especially if it's any kind of a sizable project. I would really wait until next year because it is risky. And then the other thing is fertilizing. Again, we say fall is an excellent time to fertilize. Early fall, first part of September is perfect. Right now, the risk you run if you fertilize your lawn, you may stimulate a flush of growth as we go through October that doesn't harden off properly. And then you get more problems with things like snow mold during the winter because now your lawn's really lush and succulent going into winter. And you get snow mold, you get voles and other things in there. So unfortunately. Now, on the flip side, it's still a good time if you have to address things like dandelions or ground ivy. There's time, you know, they're growing well right now. The key thing is you want those weeds actively growing, which certainly they are, as long as you got some moisture in the soil. So you've got here, you know, this first part of October is a good time still to treat broadleaf weeds. Still an excellent time to core aerate. That's the other thing I mentioned there, especially anybody that's got a sodded lawn that you maybe have some soil issues there, maybe you got some thatch problems. Really the whole month of October is fine to aerate as long as you got moisture in the soil to do so.
Bruce Bangenberg, our guest today, statewide horticulture outreach specialist in the Hort program at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Questions for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Monday at this time, we'll be taking a look at 50 years of Saturday Night Live with a local podcaster. We also talked to the director of a Christmas romance movie that was filmed in Door County. And then we'll take a look at some of this year's fall movie releases. That's on Monday. Right now, though, we're talking about plants with Bruce Spangenberg, statewide horticulture outreach specialist for UW-Madison and UW Extension. Great to have him with us. Questions, give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. Let's turn to Bob in Spooner next. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Larry. I'm calling about gentian, bottled gentian. I saw quite a batch of it this morning, and I don't know if it could be transplanted or not. Blue gentian or bottle gentian?
Gentian. I'm trying to think of how that's spelled. Is it G-E-N-T-I-A-N?
I believe that's correct, yeah.
Yeah. What do you know about it, Bruce?
I know how to spell it. it is on the list. I would suspect... if you want to propagate it, probably the best route to go would be to divide it. I don't know off the top. I have to do some research as far as if there is a seed. I'm guessing there is a seed, obviously, but if there is a process to collect the seed. And that's, again, that's something you can look at. If you do look at ways to propagate, especially the native plants in particular, a lot of them have cold requirements, you know, need to be stratified, which essentially mimics winter. Before they'll germinate. So you might have to collect them and put them into a refrigerator or a cold area to expose them to cold. And then the other thing is some of them have to be scarified. And again, it goes back to how those plants have evolved, but you might have to mix them in sand. Sometimes you have to actually treat them with things like acid to break the seed coat down. So if you are going to use seed, that's just a word of caution with any plant. Again, with the gentian, I'd have to look it up and see. I honestly don't know off the top of my head. But those are the two things you typically look at is, do they need a cold treatment? Do they need some kind of roughening or dissolving of the seed coat before they'll germinate? Because if you don't meet those requirements and just put them in the ground, nothing's going to happen. And then maybe they sit there over a season and that would occur then in the soil. But look those things up. The other thing is, of course, in the spring, as they come up, you can divide them. But there again, knowing what they look like when they come up, being on top of things, because every spring's a little bit different. But then, you know, typically most of those, when they first come up, that's the best time to divide. And when they're small, break the clumps apart, put them right back in the soil.
Yeah, and Bob's in Spooner, so you're not going to be doing that now, probably.
No, usually, you know, there might be one or two exceptions, but usually no. Because the biggest problem is what happens in the winter. You know, if you just, you divide a plant now and put it back in the ground, it may not have much opportunity to reestablish roots, and now it's prone to drying out and soil heaving and those kind of things over the winter. So wait till spring to do that. But with all these plants, do some research. There's so many good resources out there as far as propagation. And once you get the plants established, then you have the opportunity to divide them. You also have the opportunity to collect the seed and repropagate by seed. So lots of opportunities with perennials, with the non-natives as well, but especially with the natives.
Corey in Dodgeville will give you a chance now. Hi, Corey.
Hi, Larry. I have my own native seed and plant nursery, so I can answer, I can give a little more information about propagating gentian. I would guess what they saw out there was probably Gentiana andrewsii, and that would be the blue bottle gentian. And it isn't very common, so I would not recommend digging it from the wild, but you can collect the seed. The seed will probably be ready in about 3 weeks, and it hangs on really well. And then you should go ahead and put that in some moist sand, like make it cookie dough consistency, kind of massage that seed in there, pop it in the refrigerator for 6 to 8 weeks, bring it out, let it warm up, and then it will, then you can plant it, but it will sit in the soil most of the summer before germinating again then in the fall. It's one of those funny, funny germinators that kind of like the cold, wet, hot, cold before it'll germinate.
Interesting. Corey, thank you very much for calling. Good points there, Bruce.
Yeah, and that was an excellent point. You know, I've been mentioning dividing. I'm assuming these gardeners already have it in their yard and they're dividing. But obviously, as you mentioned, you don't want to go out and start digging up plants in the wild. Collect seeds is one thing, but digging up, disturbing the plant, first of all, you might be trespassing, but also you're destroying that ecosystem there and then causing problems. But yeah, I'm assuming people have them in their yard and they're transplanting and dividing their own when they are digging plants up. But there again, that's one that's, yeah, as she mentioned, it's got quite a few things to keep in mind there if you do want to have success. And there again, you have to do some research and figure out what these plants need. It all goes back to how they evolved and how they survived the winter and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Corey, thanks again. Appreciate it very much. Monica in Glendale emailed to say that the Latin name of turtlehead is Shalom obliqua. And yes, the bumblebees love to pry them open and crawl inside.
There you go.
You did a story on recycling yard waste.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that for helping your soil.
Yes. You know, backyard composting, you know, a couple things. Obviously, you're dealing with this time of year a lot of plant material as you clean up gardens, and obviously you got leaves falling off the trees and that kind of thing. So it's really two benefits. One is you take care of the waste. And then the second thing is the finished product, which is compost, is an outstanding soil amendment. You know, we always talk about amending your soils. So, you know, the basic rule is you mix green and brown together. So green would be things like, you know, grass clippings is a classic, or fresh green clippings off of any plant. Or if, you know, if you harvested carrots and you got the green tops, that, you know, the leaves, that kind of thing. Brown, obviously leaves falling off plants, dead plants, annuals, dead vegetable plants, that kind of thing. If you chop them or shred them, you know, the smaller the better, because really what you're trying to do when you compost is you're trying to make really good environment for bacteria, the aerobic bacteria, which are the oxygen bacteria. The smaller the material, the more surface area there is, the faster things are going to decompose. So you mix these together, add enough moisture, kind of the consistency of a wrung out sponge, and then enough volume, typically need about a 3x3x3 pile to get things going. So composting is not, you know, year round, but especially now, it's, if you haven't done it, it's a great time to start because you have a lot of material available. And, you know, the basic rules are just mix the materials together, make sure there's oxygen available, and avoid kitchen scraps and that kind of thing, meat, you know, fat, that kind of thing, because that's gonna not gonna decompose well. It's gonna attract animals and critters you don't want in there. But the normal composting process with oxygen does not have foul odors. It's a fairly fast process. And the finished product is compost, which is essentially the same thing as when we talk about soils, we talk about humus, which is the organic fraction of the soil. They're the same thing. So you're just adding more organic material to soil, which is great for clay soils. It's also great for sandy soils. You know, clay soils are too dense. They hold too much water. Sandy soils, the opposite. They don't hold any water. Compost works both ways. Organic material works both ways to improve both the sandy and the clay soils, as well as the soils already that are in good shape. You're just adding more organic material, which is, you can't go wrong by doing it.
No, you can't. Amy in Mequon has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Amy.
Yes, hi. I'm wondering what the correct name for our native thistle is. I've looked it up. I couldn't find it. And I know that it's good for the finches, and I'd like to grow it and have it available.
Yeah, I'm drawing a blank on that one. I'd have to do some research on that. I mean, obviously, you've got all kinds of thistles, which most of them, you know, it's usually the opposite. People want to get rid of them. But yeah, I'm not sure what the, quote, native thistle would be. There are several, but I don't know offhand exactly which one it would be.
Mark emailed that his Aurelia cordata Sun King Golden Japanese spikenard turns brown stem by stem each year, cleans it up. It cleans the area up every fall, and the plant returns every spring. And this happens to other plants in his yard and neighborhood. Is this normal?
Most likely, yes. And that's an excellent question, because that's another thing when you bring in a new plant to your landscape or your garden. At first, you may think, well, something's wrong with this plant because it's doing that. You know, bleeding hearts are an excellent example. You know, they're blooming early in the spring, got all kinds of foliage. They look great. You look at them by the end of summer, you think they got a disease because they're all turning yellow and disappearing. That's part of their cycle. You know, a lot of the early bloomers do disappear by mid to late summer. So there again, I would do some research with the plant, because most likely if you're seeing it every year and it keeps coming back and looking fine and then later it looks terrible, that is normal. It's part of its life cycle. The problem is when the opposite is when they're supposed to be blooming and they're wilting and browning, then that's a Brian question. Again, you got something going on there that you got to address. But I would first look at what's normal, the life cycle of that plant, because not all plants come up in spring, you know, in May, flower or persist over the course of the summer and then fade away now. Some of them faded away 2 months ago. That's part of their normal cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. Your articles, Wisconsin Yard and Garden, those are really good pieces. I just, when I was searching, I just typed in Wisconsin Yard and Garden article, and it was the first thing that popped up on my search engine, at least.
Yeah, I think it does. I enjoy doing it. Like, again, it's a weekly, it's on our website. It's in, I'm not sure the exact number, somewhere like 36, 38 papers statewide. We send it out, but yeah, the idea is it's timely, you know, things that are going on either problem wise or things you should be doing in your yard and garden. You know, I try to put them in there. I enjoy doing it and I do get a lot of positive feedback on it. So thank you.
Yeah. It's a great service that you're providing, Bruce. And thanks so much for taking an hour to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I always enjoy coming on the show and hearing what people have to ask. So yes. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Bruce Bangenberg, statewide horticulture outreach specialist in the horticulture program at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Had another email from Janine in Port Edwards. We'll get to that. I think it's a plant disease question. So coming up, we've got Dr. Death to talk plant diseases, and that'll be next. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Stay with us.